The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's a Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina, not Alan Chartok. Alan is not here this week, and he will return. For now, you'll get me, and I hope I can fill in his stead. We're here with the Assembly Minority Leader. He's a Republican, Brian Kolb. Welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, David. Good to see you. And I have to tell you, you're no Alan Chartok. You're taller.
Don't tell him that. Nor could I be Alan Chartok. I'm just me and will do my very best to hit you with the questions about what's happening as we sit here. Let's talk about some of the specific legislation. You have been squarely against the green light bill, which is now law. It allows driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. We've already seen county clerks upset about this, including one clerk from Erie County, Michael Mickey Kearns. He's a former assemblyman. He already says he's not going to honor the law. You know, the proponents say, let's get these people in the system. Let's have the insurance paid. You know, let's not act like they're not here. And a lot of the fears, they say, of the opponents will not bear out. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts is, first and foremost, a driver's license in this state is not a right, it's a privilege. And you're supposed to be here as a legal citizen of New York State and also our country. And the folks that they're granting driver's licenses to are not citizens. They're not here legally, which means they're here illegally. And to provide a privilege is thumbing the nose at every law-abiding, tax-paying citizen in this state that has paid their dues to earn that privilege. And this is going back to when you're going to school and, you know, taking your driver ed classes and, you know, getting your driver's test passed. And so I think it's just an affront. And if you look at really and you talk to people on the street, and even the polling is overwhelmingly against this idea. And certainly I think people, they're just rolling their eyes and saying, what's next? And it's a matter of fairness, but it's a matter of what I would call almost a civic duty that you're granting something to someone that is here on non-legal terms.
Well, let's stick with immigrants for a minute, because I'm sure you would agree that immigrants who are here legally certainly provide quite an impact to our economy. But then there is also a number of illegal immigrants who are here working, many to support their families, not here for any other purpose because they couldn't get opportunity where they came from. Should we be doing something to help these immigrants who do add to what's now an underground economy?
Well, certainly, you know, this country has always had open borders and welcome anyone and everyone from across the globe. It's been our history. And as they used to pass by the Statue of Liberty many, many years ago in a boat, this country has been known for welcoming in open arms. Yet what's changed goes back to 9/11, which we were talking about before the show. You have people, terrorists, that their main mission in life is to harm the United States in any way, shape, or form. And so it's a different world we're living in today, and it's about making sure we know who's here, why they're here, and then if there's a way to encourage them to become United States citizens, we should have that pathway. But certainly, we have laws for a reason. If you don't have laws, you have chaos. And then, you know, a simple thing, you know, people all of a sudden say, I'm not going to stop at any red light or any stop sign, or I'm going to talk on the phone and cause an accident or text on the phone. I mean, this is where chaos comes into play. So it's, we advocate open arms and we want people here. But my fundamental question always would be is, what is it that's stopping those folks that want to live here, want to work here, want to become part of the, you know, the American dream? Why won't they become a citizen? What's stopping them from becoming a citizen? maybe there's some obstacles that we can make it a little bit easier if that's the problem.
Well, let me quickly interrupt and just throw in this group, farm workers, because we have farmers that are hurting in this state. And many of them do end up relying, whether they know it or not sometimes, on illegal undocumented workers to do that farm work. Is a group like that someone you're talking about?
Well, I think we're talking about any immigrant that wants to come into this country, whether it's to work part-time or seasonal. We just need to have a process. And who sets up that process? It's the federal government. And certainly, I come from an agricultural region. Certainly, they're debating this Farm Worker Bill of Rights as we speak right now. And I think that we have to have a pathway, and let's create a pathway that makes sense for everybody, and that yet is not having an open border where the people that we don't want streaming in or sneaking in, that's what we have to balance.
I mean, you referenced the Statue of Liberty. Obviously, New York is the symbol of the openness to the world and immigrants coming here to become citizens of this country. And you do, I just ask you this because it's in the top of the news, with President Trump kicking off his 2020 campaign in Florida, talking shortly before that about next week rounding up millions of undocumented immigrants. Seems like you're spreading a lot of fear in the nation.
Well, certainly I think that can be perceived that way. And I don't know if this is just campaign rhetoric or whether there is really a program going on. But certainly that's why we have a United States Senate. That's why we have the House of Representatives. That should be working together and with the president to come up with some common sense immigration policy. It's a countrywide issue, and that's what is not being done in Washington, and that's why people are frustrated. And you know, rhetoric is rhetoric, and both sides throw out rhetoric all the time. You know, it isn't one party that does that sort of positioning or pandering, and so we'll have to wait and see.
I didn't realize until I read this from your website, Leader Kolb, and we were speaking with Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, who's a Republican. A minimum wage increase for prison inmates?
Yes, that's what the governor and others are proposing, and I'm opposed to that, as many others are. Certainly, we're providing, you know, really free room and board and educational assistance for those that are incarcerated, and basically say, all right, we're going to use more taxpayer money to give them more money to buy whatever they want from the commissary or whatever they're, you know, purchasing. And I think it's just a wrong priority. And I think, again, if you just talk to the average hardworking taxpaying citizen in this state, establishing this as a priority, does that make sense to the people I represent? And even though I'm certainly the minority leader in the New York State Assembly, but I also represent 131,000 people in my assembly district. And I've taken polls online and also through a constituent survey. And any of these major issues, my constituents back home in the 131st Assembly District are saying, no way should we be doing these types of policies. And so my job is to represent how they think. And it should never really, quite frankly, be about personal opinion about a legislator. You're there to represent the people that sent you to Albany or Washington.
Well, while we're on the subject of prison and inmates, what about solitary confinement? Because, of course, there is this issue of whether this is really just inhumane to do to human beings.
Well, you know, quite frankly, I've been in correctional facilities, but I've never actually physically have seen a solitary confinement jail. But I do know that talking to correctional officers, I've been to a variety of different facilities. I used to represent Five Points in Southern Seneca County. But very early in my time in the legislature, I served on the Corrections Committee. And so had the opportunity to visit a lot of facilities. And what you're still dealing with at times is a very dangerous, volatile situation. Even with the correctional guards, the men and women that serve in our correctional institutions, they're always at risk. They're not armed. They can't be armed. And certainly there are inmates, incarcerated individuals, that can be very dangerous to themselves, can be very dangerous to the prison population or to staff. And sometimes the only way to do that is to segregate them in a confined space and area. Now, to me, you know, the best way to avoid solitary confinement is do not commit a crime and do not go to jail. So if you do not commit a crime and then you're not sentenced to jail by a jury or a judge in our criminal justice system, then there's no need for solitary confinement. And I think this is what gets lost on what I'll call the people that are saying that we're inhumane. What about the crimes that were committed by the people that are now incarcerated? What about the victims, what they've gone through? This is why we've had a parole board that's now releasing cop killers. It's outrageous. So again, I think it's something that you have a person that heads up the Department of Corrections, that works for the state, that works for the governor. If this is a very difficult situation, then maybe there's things that they can recommend. But I think in the beginning, we don't have to have jails if we don't have people committing crimes.
We also do have, I think, acknowledged problems with jails like Rikers Island.
Correct. Yes. There are some facilities that just need to be either overhauled or replaced or renovated. You have to have livable, humane conditions. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I guess a livable, humane condition in the New York State legislature would be if the Republican minority had more input into the budget process. We had a little bit of a pre-conversation about this. But, you know, you watch the budget process go through every single year. You're the Republican in the minority. Alan likes to say you have the power of warm spit. But, you know, you have your ways of making your influence. But how much are the Republicans involved this year in this process?
Well, first of all, you have to separate whether you're in the room with the governor and the other legislative leaders versus outside the room where you're advocating, introducing legislation, promoting different policies that end up taking effect. And what people forget that everyone loves the property tax cap, except maybe some of the local governments or school districts, but the taxpayer loves the property tax cap. Well, the property tax cap started with the Assembly Republican Conference. And this was back when Jim Tedesco was the minority leader. And
now a senator, of course.
Now a senator. And there are other things, cap on Medicaid costs. These came from the Assembly Republicans.
So they steal your ideas.
They absolutely do. And in the end, in fact, I think it was Ronald Reagan that said it. It's not important that you get the credit. It's important that you try to get some of these things done. Several years ago, Governor Cuomo and the two majorities had stripped $90 million out of the budget for the developmentally disabled. Well, on our debate floor, we railed against, it was in the Assembly, of course, against the Assembly Democrats for going along with this and signing off on this negotiated budget. Well, guess what? The $90 million got restored. The Be Fair for Direct Care initiative, the Assembly Republicans were the first legislative conference to appear at press conferences, to stand shoulder to shoulder with these folks that provide vital services to those most in need. And I remember in the standing up in the crowd in the state capitol, and all of a sudden Andrew Cuomo comes walking down the hallway and steps up to point for, I'm going to give you $35 million. Well, that all came from the people with the Be Fair to Direct Care movement, but most importantly, the Assembly Republicans were the ones standing by their side to start putting the pressure on the others. So we do have an impact. It's just that no one likes to acknowledge it.
Right. And that's the part, I guess, that, you know, give the credit where the credit is due. Is this because sometimes party labels get in the way of just having a fair conversation?
Well, you know, I think that's what we've changed, at least from our side in the Assembly. We are very animated and focused on our debates, but we don't focus on whether someone's a Democrat or not. We really focus in on whether this is a good idea, a bad idea, or a sort of a good idea that could be made better. And that's what we do on the debate floor and in committees. We've actually stopped legislation with Democrats to not come out of committee sometimes because of our, what I would call, reasoned arguments and discussions. Bills have been amended after our debates based on these types of input. That's our job, and we take pride in doing that. I think what's happened in Albany, same thing that's happened in Washington, that the people don't, they've done it for so long, we've always done it this way, so who's ever in the majority gets to, you know, put their fists on their hips and say, we're in charge, we're going to do it our way, even though it could be done a lot better. And that's what we're saying is, you could do this so much better, and you could keep your power. You still got the votes. But wouldn't it be a grand idea not to go out and twist arms to get a vote on a bill or in a committee when the anti-vaccine bill, Speaker Hastie actually came in and got a Assembly Democrat in committee to change his vote, even though he voted against it in committee first. Well, you shouldn't be doing that. If the votes aren't there in committee, it should stop right there. That's the process. And so that's the sort of thing that we really try to always be a watchdog of and to try to push for better, not efficiencies because it sounds too cold, but a really a more integrated process where rank and file legislators do have input. They can vote their conscience without having their arms twisted or even threatened. And that's why there hasn't been a capital appropriation bill yet, because the governor won't sign off on it because he's using it as an anvil against the two majorities. So they have a difficult time going back to their members to get funding for their districts. It's outrageous. And this is what is the frustrating part, is that not as a Republican, but as a good government advocate, a better government advocate.
And over the years, we hear that same argument when the Senate Republicans were in the majority there and the Democratic minority leader would come in here and tell us a lot of the same thing. So this isn't specific to either party. You know, this happens when you're in the minority. So now we haven't even talked about Leader Kolb, and we're speaking with New York State Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, who's a Republican. These internal rules and you get a committee assignment, you get a bigger office space, they can starve you of resources. These are the kinds of internal power games that play into all of this process that you're talking about as well.
Well, of course, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, who's now the majority leader in the Senate, she was joining me at the hip saying we should be in the room in budget discussions and major policy discussions. And whatever the votes are with the legislative leaders, the votes are. But everybody should be in that room. And Stewart-Cousins has been absolutely silent since she became a majority leader and not pushing publicly to have John Flanagan in the room. And so, you know, this is the nonsense. Okay, you thought this was the right idea when you're the minority leader. You should be advocating for it now that you're the majority leader. And that's one thing that I really respected David Paterson when he was governor for that very short time.
Interesting.
He did bring in the minority leaders. And I was there. And I remember having a discussion with all the leaders about education funding. And when we're all said and done, Governor Paterson said, Brian, they really don't want you guys in the room. And I said, well, I know that. But you can all vote against whatever we're proposing. You got four legislative leaders and a governor. So if you get 3 out of 5, you win whatever it is you want to do, right? But at least you have an opportunity to say why it could be better or why you shouldn't do it that way. And that's because we, each conference, the minority conferences in the Senate and the Assembly, represent millions of New Yorkers from all across the state, including New York City. We should have at least a voice in that room saying, yeah, these are some of the things our conference thinks. And then where it goes from there and votes, it goes from there.
So can we say that in a representative democracy, we really shouldn't have an oligarchy ruling the state of New York?
I think that'd be more than a fair assessment from my perspective. And I think if you ask the average person on the street, they'll tell you the same thing.
Well, let's talk about Carl Hastie for a second. He's your leader in that House. How have things been going? Has he been trying to include you in? Is he a David Paterson-like person, or is he a little more toward the anvil type leader?
Well, first of all, I got a very good relationship with Carl Hastie. He has a job to do and I have a job to do. And we respect the fact that each of us has a job to do. And we don't make it personal. Certainly, he has been more open-minded to working on things in the legislature as the operation of the place in terms of whatever things you need to operate your office or members do or staff do. And so he has not played any political games in that regard. Now, Sheldon Silver, on the other hand, was much more punitive in his approach. And by the way, I probably got along with Shelley Silver better than most, but that's because I didn't attack him personally. And I really don't adhere to that philosophy, attacking personally. And when Governor Cuomo first got elected, I said, Governor, I'm going to disagree with you, and I'm going to say it publicly, but I'm not going to attack you personally. I don't think it's helpful. But my relationship, I would say, with Carl is very good, but we both understand that there's things we have to do in our jobs that are in direct opposite view of them doing or Carl doing his job.
The fox and the hound.
Well, a little bit. We're the fox and the fox. But
the fox and the fox.
Fox has got a bigger paw than I do.
I love it. We're speaking with Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. Well, you mentioned the governor. Could you pick up the phone and call the governor? Will the governor take your call?
I don't know. I send him letters.
Does he reply?
No. And I think that is unfortunate. And basically, every year since I've been leader, I send a letter to him outlining some things that we would be advocating for or concerned about in the budget. And I also copy the other legislative leaders just to say, hey, if you're not going to pick up the phone or reach out to us, I'm going to reach out to you. And I prefer to do it in writing because then there's no nebulous, well, he misunderstood me or I didn't stand him on the phone. You know how that goes.
Does your counterpart do that in the Senate, John
Flanagan? I have no idea.
You're not sure. Okay, please continue.
No, so I think it's important. And if there are other things that I think that raise to the level, could I call him if I felt it was necessary to call him? Of course. And I'm sure if he had something to convey in communication, he would pick up the phone and call me.
Maybe even his staff might reach out and say, to your staff, you know, let's talk a little bit more about what's on the minority leader's mind.
In my beginning years later, I would get the calls from at budget time from some of the governor's staff and say, you know, hey, you need to move this along a little bit. And we'd say, no, you don't understand the process. And we are not going to go out on the floor and vote as Assembly Republicans until we've looked at the bills, we've read the bills, we've had staff brief us their perspective on the bills. When we've done that, then we're ready to vote. But we're not intentionally dragging out the process. But it's amazing. Year after year, when they're trying to meet that midnight deadline, you get the phone call and say, hey, how come you guys are taking so long in conference? It's because we're doing our jobs in discussing the legislation that you've all been working on privately for weeks, if not a month. So you've all say, well, we know what this all, that's great, but we get to vote too. And you're not going to take away that very right that we've earned as an elected representative of the people we represent. So we're going to make sure we understand. And we do. Our conference knows legislation better than the very sponsors of these bills. We do our homework. I've not once have ever said to a member of my conference, you have to vote this way. You vote your conscience and you vote the way your district wants you to vote because they're the ones that have sent you here. And they don't do that in the majority. They just say, this is the deal we've constructed. And now they've got to try to sell it. And it's a just totally different approach.
And we wonder why there's apathy towards state and national politics.
Of course.
Let's talk a little bit about rent control, that landmark legislation passed. It includes opt-ins for upstate. We need a little more of the details there, but your thoughts on that legislation?
Well, first of all, it's a very comprehensive piece of legislation that would be very difficult to do justice to in this show because of the time constraints. I will say, in my personal opinion, I think this is a terrible piece of legislation. There shouldn't be any opt-in provisions for upstate. It's a solution looking for a problem. And based on conversations with the real estate industry in New York City, they believe that this particular bill, as passed, will have devastating effects to the housing market in New York City. And I've already heard from people that they're looking at once whatever's under construction is done, that you're going to see an absolute stoppage, work stoppage, which is going to mean loss of construction jobs, loss of further investments into these properties. And the thing is with some of these policies, David, and to your listeners, you don't feel that impact right this second, right this today. It could be a 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 year is where you finally see the impact of what's being done today. And that's hard for the average person to grasp is because after you hear, well, this rent regulation passed and there's an opt-in provision for New York, well, they haven't felt anything. So they can't really react to it. And by the time they find out how this is really not a great idea or how they've constructed it, it's too late. And then even if you said, okay, we're now going to reverse course 4 years from now, it's going to take another 3 to 4 years to reverse the course that has just been set. It's the dynamics. Anytime when government is trying to interfere in a free market society and put regulations in, you're going to do it our way. It costs more. It discourages investment. And actually, eventually people say, I don't want to do business in New York State. And, kind of that was what happened with Amazon.
Let's turn to the Republican Party itself. You have a new chair.
We do.
Nick Langworthy, he's former Erie County chair. He's taken over for Ed Cox, who's gone to work for President Trump's 2020 campaign. I think the undercurrent of this would be that based on the last midterm election, New York State was hit pretty hard. Ed Cox maybe lost the confidence of some of the folks in New York, some of the Republican leaders. And it looked like Mr. Langworthy moved very quickly to get endorsements and move into the place. Ed gets a soft landing. And Nick seems to be taking it perhaps a little more to the right.
I wouldn't say that. I think that Nick Langworthy has been a Erie County chairman for sure. He's worked in the legislative side. He used to work for Congressman Tom Reynolds. I think that's where Nick began to cut his teeth. He was also head of the Young Republican Party. Nick is a solid Republican and believes in the principle and values that the Republican Party attempts to advocate. If you can get through all the media noise that basically says, they're far-right people and they don't care about people, it couldn't be farther from the truth. We've been so mislabeled. And I experienced that in my short run for exploring the run for governor. You're Donald Trump. I'm not Donald Trump. I'm Brian Kolb. Look at my record. Ask me about my record. And Nick Langworthy, I'm really impressed. He is going to every corner of the state, including New York City. In fact, he was just there this week, appearing with Joe Borelli, and basically saying, Bill de Blasio, either come home and be mayor of New York City or resign.
He's running for president.
And that's Nick Langworthy. He's already demonstrated a much more proactive, and he's not about he wasn't slamming Bill de Blasio because he's run for president. He was saying, you should be here running one of the largest cities in the world and not being out campaigning for president when you have absolutely no shot. And if you're going to run for president, then step down as mayor of New York. And that's Nick Langworthy. And he said he's going to go corner to corner of these states about the values or the pros and cons of public policy. And I think he's going to be a great chairman. I really do.
Now, we saw a recent Siena poll that said that the people of New York don't want Governor Cuomo to run for a fourth term. Now, who you got?
For a fourth term?
To run against the governor.
Run against Governor Cuomo?
In other words, if Nick's going around the state, will he be able to find someone that can take on the governor?
I absolutely think so. Is there names that have been already kind of floated a little bit? Congressman Lee Zeldin, Harry Wilson, who didn't run last time. There could be others that
will come
into play. Mark Might. The real issue here is running for governor is the governor has such an advantage to be an incumbent. Also because he has such huge leverage over the budget process and where money's spent and how it's spent. And I think that's what's going to come to roost. It's all about, can you raise the money to compete? Is there enough things to message against Governor Cuomo and what he's done as governor or not done? The answer is yes. Now you got to have money to get your message out. Mark Molinaro, great elected official, has done a terrific job in Dutchess County, didn't have the resources to get his message out. And that's really the bellwether. You don't have to have the exact amount of money, but you have to have something with close.
New York State Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, a Republican. Brian, the fact that you come in regularly is something I know our listeners appreciate very much and hope keep coming back.
Absolutely. I enjoy it very much. And to all your listeners, hope you have a very safe, happy, healthy summer.